The following program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering the towns of Fitchburg, Leominster, Lancaster, Lunenburg, Townsend, Ashby, Ashburnham, Devons, Westminster, Shirley, and Groton. This program is made possible in part by a grant from the Community Foundation of North Central Massachusetts and the Lions Clubs of Fitchburg and Lunenburg. And thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. During the next hour, we'll be reading from the Sentinel and Enterprise newspaper. This is Priscilla Lanigan, along with Stacey Lanier, reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. Okay, first up, if you're not doing anything tonight, Fitchburg State to host Jazz Night April 29th. That's today. Christine Fossen and local students to highlight event. The Fitchburg's Modern Jazz Band, and that's BYRDS, will present its second annual Jazz Night celebration with singer and trumpeter Christine Fossen on Wednesday, April 29th at 7 p.m. in the Weston Auditorium at Fitchburg State University, 353 North Street. The event includes performances by the Leominster and Lunenburg Public Schools jazz bands, who will also participate in a master class with Fossen that afternoon. We are so excited to be able to bring this amazing artist to work with our students and the students of the local schools, said Fitchburg State Associate Professor of Humanities Amy McLaughlin. There are many people to thank for helping to bring this about, including the Fitchburg Cultural Council, El Toro Promotions, Crocker Center, and the Admissions Office. Admission is free and open to the public. To learn more about Fitchburg State University's instrumental and choral groups, visit fitchburgstate.edu/music. And from Townsend, Visual Record of Our Past. Model T program presents photos from 1927 road trip. Bob Arnold's upcoming presentation will include the story, along with scores of photographs from his family's 18,000-mile 1927 road trip around the United States in a Ford Model T. This is a fascinating program, which I saw in Sturbridge last year, said town resident John Barrett of the event taking place on Sunday, May 3rd at 2 p.m. in Memorial Hall, 272 Main Street, as in Townsend. He added that the Yankee Ingenuities, the local chapter of the Model T Ford Club of America, in conjunction with the Townsend Historical Society's celebration of America's 250th birthday, is sponsoring the event that showcases the epic adventure that took place nearly a century ago. Arnold said that in 1927, his grandparents, Carrie and Maud Melville, made an 8-month-long road trip with their three children, packing everyone into a Model T touring car named Hubbub with attached trailer. The Melvilles left their home in Worcester in January of that year with the objective of traveling the entire periphery of the United States and, as his grandmother noted in one of her many journals, finding out the out-of-the-way places and experiencing the natural wonders that the country has to offer. The issues these travelers encountered stand in sharp contrast to what we find when we set out on a road trip today, Arnold said. Many roads were unpaved and unnamed, often little more than trails that were muddy in the rain and dusty the rest of the time. And the business of providing travel and roadside amenities from gas to food was in its infancy, often with options few and far between. Carrie Melville had taken a year-long sabbatical from his teaching position at Clark University, which provided the time for the road trip. He was an accomplished amateur photographer, and more than 100 of his photographs from the trip are featured in the program, illustrating both the joys and the trials of cross-country travel in 1927, Arnold said. He himself is a freelance photographer, amateur historian, and avid collector of all things Sturbridge, where Arnold has called home for well over a half a century, and he lives with his wife Susan, their dog Jesse, and thousands of images. In addition to serving clients throughout New England, Arnold has been documenting life in his community since he and his family moved to Sturbridge in 1970. His work over the past 55-plus years has yielded, in his words, a unique perspective on the commercial, cultural, and environmental changes in our community, and his ongoing efforts relating to digital preservation of documents and photographic images assures that future generations will have access to the visual record of our past. Very good. Oh, and then from Fitchburg, police investigating shooting near Fitchburg State Campus. Police are investigating a shooting that occurred Monday night in the area of Clinton Street near the Fitchburg State University campus. On Monday, April 27, 2026, at approximately 6:38 p.m., the Fitchburg Police Department received reports of shots fired in the area of Clinton Street. Responding officers located an individual with a single gunshot wound to the leg and provided first aid until ambulance personnel arrived on scene. The victim was transported to a nearby hospital and is being treated for an injury that is not considered life-threatening. At this time, there is no indication that this incident is connected to Fitchburg State University, according to a release from the Fitchburg Police Department. The Clinton Street area has been secured, and there is no known ongoing threat to the public. The investigation remains active and is being conducted by the Fitchburg Police Department's Patrol Division, along with detectives from the Bureau of Criminal Investigation. No arrests have been made at this time. If anyone has any information that could assist with this investigation, please contact the Fitchburg Police Department's Bureau of Criminal Investigation at 978-345-9650. In a Facebook post, reply, Fitchburg Mayor Samantha Squalia posted a statement that went out to the campus community from Fitchburg State University President Donna Hodge about the Monday night shooting. As the situation developed, we alerted campus to avoid the area while police managed an active investigation. Based on what was known at the time, this was not an active shooter moving through the community, but a targeted, localized incident, said the statement from Hodge posted by Squalia. Okay. Also from Fitchburg, Fitchburg State elevates vet support to gold status. In his first year leading veteran and military service at Fitchburg State University, Director of Military and Veteran Services Nolan Buck set out to make the office more accessible and effective for student veterans navigating complicated systems. When asked what that looked like, Buck said, collaboration on campus and then also a building, a community, having students that feel safe and welcome in a space that's specifically for them. That vision translated into structural changes that helped the university earn gold military-friendly status, a step up from its previous silver designation. In the past, we didn't have a director, didn't have a department, so those things were updated, Buck said. Gold military-friendly status is a national designation awarded through the Military-Friendly Schools Program, which evaluates colleges and universities based on how well they support veterans, active duty service members, and their families. Schools are assessed on factors such as student retention and graduation rates, availability of dedicated veteran resources, financial aid and benefit processing, and overall campus culture. Achieving gold status places an institution in the top tier of participating schools, signaling a strong, measurable commitment to veteran success, both inside and outside the classroom. In a statement released by Fitchburg State, President Donna Hodge said the designation reflects the university's continued commitment to those who have served, emphasizing the importance of providing strong academic and personal support systems for military-connected students. For Buck, the recognition is less about prestige and more about validation. It helps us recognize the mission that we're continuing to do here, and having this office and having a director is communicated across the whole community. We have two students certifying, student certifying officials now, so things like that added to the equation to get us the gold status. A certifying official is an employee who acts as the official liaison between the school and the Department of Veterans Affairs, VA, to report student enrollment information and to assist students. These employees ensure veterans and eligible dependents receive VA benefits. The office's daily operation reflects the mission of supporting veterans and their community. We're a jack of all trades, honestly, Buck said. A lot of it is collaboration. The VA system at large is a very complex system, and there's a lot of moving parts, and it's always changing, he added. Every day is different, and there's never a stagnant day. Fitchburg State has been designated a military-friendly institution for the 11th consecutive year and joins such peer institutions in gold status as Suffolk University, Regis College, Boston College, Middlesex Community College, and Bristol Community College. Looking ahead, Buck emphasized advocacy. It's still getting our voice out more on campus, getting more key figures involved, Buck added. At the end of the day, it's a numbers game, too. Always recruiting and advocating for students. It's a very yes mentality here. And it's not just one department. It's multiple departments that are contributing and helping out. Ultimately, Buck believes impact spreads organically. If we're able to help that one student, it's going to be a trickling effect, he said. Word might just go around saying, hey, these services are great. Okay. And from Leominster, amazed at the generosity, local auto shop collecting food for nonprofit. Multi-generational family-owned and operated city business Lanza Auto is once again proud to be partnering with the United Way of North Central Massachusetts for their annual spring food drive. The crew at Lanza is collecting non-perishable food items through June 3rd that will be donated to Ginny's Helping Hand and in turn distributed to local families in need. They are grateful for the area residents joining them in their efforts to address food insecurity and welcome donations such as grape jelly and peanut butter, pasta and sauce, shelf-stable milk and cereal, canned goods, and more to be dropped off at their 1233 Central Street garage. Every time we do this event, I'm always amazed at the generosity of our customers, friends, and family, said Tim Lanza, who helps run the repairs and maintenance shop open to all makes and models of vehicles that his dad founded over 52 years ago. We have been one of the largest collection locations for local food, the local food drive, and it is all thanks to the incredibly generous people connected to Lanza Auto. He first connected with United Way of North Central Massachusetts Director of Resource Development, Jacqueline Mayo, in the spring of 2024 at an event hosted by the Fitchburg-headquartered North Central Massachusetts Chamber of Commerce. I expressed to her that we were looking for ways to give back to the community, and she felt the food drive was a perfect opportunity, Lanza said, of the woman who has worked with nonprofits throughout Worcester County and Greater Boston. Food is a basic necessity for all of us, and I feel that those of us with more than enough need to help those who do not have enough. When asked why it is important to him and his dad that the staff there to do this meaningful gesture that has now become an annual tradition, Lanza said that the reason we are able to have a business is because of support from members of our community. I feel like it's our obligation as business owners to do what we can to show support back to community members that need it the most, he said. Ginny's Helping Hand Executive Director Brandon Robbins said they are thankful for community partners like Lanza Auto stepping up to aid them in what his nonprofit organization does for so many in the region. At Ginny's, our mission is about offering a hand up to our neighbors and partners like Lanza Auto and what makes that possible, he said. When a local business opens its doors and rallies the community around a food drive, they're doing more than filling our shelves. They're helping us support families during a hard stretch so they can find steady ground again. That's the heart of a hand up. Jim and his team understand that Leominster takes care of its own, and we're deeply grateful for their partnership. Lanza said they're more than happy to help their fellow community members, a win for everyone all around. It is incredibly rewarding for myself and the guys to be part of giving back, he said. We are so grateful for the opportunity to be more deeply involved with the community and facilitate giving back to those who need help just putting food on the table. Okay, it's coming up on 4:15 and a half. Good time to take a break, and Stacy will have more after this.
Are you elderly or disabled? Did you know each WRTA fixed-route bus has a number of accessibility features such as a ramp to enter, a kneeler which can lower the bus, a securement area for wheelchairs and other mobility devices, priority seating for people with disabilities, electronic signage on the front, side, and rear exterior, a bicycle rack on the front exterior, an interior stop request sign, automated audio and visual stop announcements. Let us make your transportation needs easier and ride the bus with us. Call us with questions at 508-791-9782 or visit our website at www.therta.com.
Welcome back to Community News for the Fitchburg and Leominster area on Audio Journal. It's that time in our program to read the obituaries from this past week. We'll begin with Elizabeth Beth S. Buckley of Leominster, died peacefully on April 21st at the Life Care Center of Leominster, surrounded by her family. Beth was born May 10, 1935, attended St. Bernard's High School, where she met the love of her life, Connie Buckley, and she graduated as a member of the class of 1953. She attended Anna Maria College, earning a bachelor's degree in elementary education and music education in 1957. Following graduation, she began her teaching career in Ashburnham. She and Connie were married on April 10th, 1959, and after spending several years at home with her children, Beth returned to teaching music in the Leominster Public Schools. Her love of music and her faith led her to direct three choirs at St. Leo's. She later served for many years as choir director at St. Boniface Church in Lunenburg. In 92, she retired from teaching and joined her husband in the family business C.E. Buckley Incorporated, where she managed the Religious Gifts bookstore until she retired in 2006. Family was central to Beth's life. She took great pride in being a grandmother and a great-grandmother. She delighted in hosting family gatherings and holiday celebrations, always welcoming everyone into her home. She also loved attending her granddaughter's field hockey games during high school and college. Beth is survived by her daughter, Patty Buckley Malcolmson, her son, Neil Buckley, and her son-in-law, David Brough, all of Leominster. She's also survived by seven granddaughters and four great-grandchildren. She was predeceased by her husband, Connie, in 2002, and her eldest daughter, Mary Beth Brough, in 2019. The family would like to extend thanks to the staff at Manor on the Hill and to the staff at Life Care Center of Leominster. If you'd like to make a memorial donation, you can do so to the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Her services were held earlier this week. All right, continuing from Leominster, Clevia E. Murphy, 89 years old, died April 19th at Holy Trinity Rehab Center in Worcester. She has joined her beloved husband of 54 years, who died in 2011, and she leaves her four children, Kathleen Daly of Westminster, Linda Murphy of Leominster, Richard D. Murphy, Jr. of Leominster, and Daniel Murphy of Sterling. She also leaves nine grandchildren and two great-granddaughters. Born June 1, 1936, she was a lifelong resident of Leominster. After graduating from Leominster High, Clevia served as a Morse code operator for Western Union, a career she held until she married. Affectionately known as Nanny, she was the heartbeat of her family, ensuring that her grandchildren grew up steeped in the Italian traditions of her San Giovanni Rotunda heritage. From her childhood home on Elm Hill Avenue to her own table on Grant Street, she kept the spirit of the Sunday feast alive. Clevia always had a smile on her face, kind words, and compassion for whoever needed. Clevia's family extends thanks to the Holy Trinity Rehabilitation Center in Worcester. If you'd like to make a memorial donation, you can make it to the American Cancer Society. Calling hours are tomorrow, Thursday, April 30th, in the Richardson Funeral Home in Leominster from 5 to 7. The funeral mass will be held Friday, May 1st at 11 in Holy Family Parish in Leominster, burial to follow in the St. Leo Cemetery. All right, turning to Fitchburg now. Christy Ann Gustafson. Christy Ann Gustafson, Wright, beloved wife of Dennis Wright, passed at home in Fitchburg on April 16th, 9 days before her 70th birthday. Born in Danbury, Connecticut, Christy is survived by her husband of 38 years, as well as her brother Keith Gustafson and her stepmother Joyce Gustafson. Christy was a graduate of Danbury High School. She was formerly employed as a manager at Walmart, and Christy will be cremated. All right, here's one from Lunenburg. Marlene Woods, 88, passed away on April 8th. She leaves behind her sister, Marilyn Abbott of Westminster, two daughters, Julie Carey of Ashburnham, Cindy Wagner Pittman of Ballston Spa, New York, also three grandchildren and four great-grandchildren. Marlene and her husband, Bill Woods, began one of the first temporary placement services in Fitchburg, Workaday, as well as All-American Temps for over 20 years. She'll be remembered for her quick wit, her love for animals, and her love for family. She loved a good day at the casino. She also wrapped the most beautiful Christmas packages, usually so beautiful you almost didn't want to open them. She made a lot of good friends from Florida to Massachusetts. We will miss you, Mom. Calling hours will be held, they'll be held next Wednesday, May 6th, from 11 to 1 in the Richardson Funeral Home, with a burial to follow in Evergreen Cemetery. And going a little further afield, here's an obituary from Columbia, South Carolina. Anita Teresa Como passed away on April 22nd, surrounded by her family. She was born in Fitchburg on October 16th, 1948. She is survived by her husband of 57 years, Joseph Al Como of Columbia, her sons, Joe or Joey Como of Lexington, South Carolina, Jim or Jimmy Como, also of Lexington, South Carolina, and Randy Como of Northport, Florida. She is also survived by nine grandchildren. Anita worked as an EMT for many years, became a CPR instructor, and pursued a career in phlebotomy. She also enjoyed volunteering and spending time with the ladies of the American Legion Auxiliary. She particularly enjoyed filling her home with the stories, love, and laughter brought by family and friends. The family will hold a private memorial service. And if you'd like to make a donation, the family suggests St. Jude's Children's Hospital. All right. We finished those obituaries very quickly, so let's turn to some news articles. This one is entitled Art in Bloom. And it says, Fitchburg Art Museum exhibit ends today, but that was Sunday. The champagne reception for the Fitchburg Art Museum's Art in Bloom exhibit on Friday evening was a swanky affair that highlighted all the beautiful creations on display throughout the space. The Laurelwood Garden Club, in partnership with the Fitchburg Art Museum, brought the return of the 28th annual Art in Bloom celebration. Local florists, artists, museum staff, and Laurelwood Garden Club and community members crafted gorgeous floral arrangements and installation inspired by works of art on view in the galleries. Local officials, including Mayor Sam Sequela, Fitchburg City Council President Anthony Zarella, Fitchburg State University President Donna Hodge, State Representative Mike Kushmerick, and many others attended the champagne reception. Everyone was given a program that included a map where all of the Art in Bloom pieces were located in the museum. In all, over 40 unique, one-of-a-kind creations bursting with vivid, colorful blooms. The Laurelwood Garden Club dedicated this year's Art in Bloom to the club's co-founder, Catherine or K. Previte, who died October at the age of 102. We honor and thank Kay for her dedication, floral guidance, and mentoring our members, read a tribute in the exhibit program. Her work continues to inspire the Laurelwood Garden Club members to participate in the success of the annual Art in Bloom. The Garden Club president, Sarah Gammel, said they're happy to honor Previte, who was instrumental in the club's success, and she revealed the winner of this year's Art in Bloom. Townsend resident Jacqueline LeCoyer took home the top prize for her piece titled Abundantia, which features two jawbones of cows from her property, along with dried mushrooms and various flora. "It is magnificent," Gammel said of LeCoyer's piece, which was located on the first floor. The other big announcement of the evening came from Capasso, who disclosed that the Rollstone Bank and Trust recently presented the museum with a $100,000 gift that will enable it to continue offering free admission for all museum visitors through 2029. "We are excited to participate with the Art Museum," said Rollstone Bank and Trust President Mary Beth Jokula. She's the first woman to run the Fitchburg headquartered corporation in its history and shared that Rollstone is celebrating its 180th anniversary. "Let's celebrate," she said after Capasso thanked them for their generous donation. That is a generous donation. So you can go to the Fitchburg Art Museum for free anytime you want. That's great. All right. This next article is from Leominster, where every step matters. Beacon of Hope's 33rd annual walk coming May 3rd. For many who gather each spring at Barrett Park, the steps taken during Beacon of Hope's annual Walk for Hope are more than symbolic. They are deeply personal. On May 3rd, the organization will hold its 33rd annual walk, bringing together families, caregivers, and community members in support of adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. The event raises funds for programming and also serves as a living tribute to individuals whose presence continues to shape the Beacon of Hope community. This year's walk is in memory of Frank Bovenzi, Mary Morizzo, and Sue Morizzo, three individuals remembered not only for their support of the organization, but for the warmth and connection they brought to it. Frank Bovenzi was a familiar and welcoming presence at the walk, often greeting participants at the finish line with pizza and a smile. He also supported Beacon of Hope through his involvement in a bocce group that rallied behind the organization. Mary Morizzo, grandmother of participant Nick Morizzo, is described as a devoted supporter who believed deeply in the organization's mission. Sue Morizzo, Nick's stepmother, shared that same spirit of generosity. She was a regular participant in the walk. She also contributed her time and energy in ways that strengthened the organization's programs and events. Beyond Remembrance, Beacon of Hope continues its year-round mission of support. The organization currently serves more than 50 adults ages 18 and older through its evening respite program held Wednesdays and Fridays at St. Anna's Church. Participants share a meal and take part in activities, while caregivers receive several hours of respite. Designed to be inclusive and accessible, the walk offers participants of all ages and abilities a scenic loop around the pond, as well as access to the park's trails. The event is free to attend, though participants are encouraged to gather pledges or make personal donations. Proceeds support Beacon of Hope's programming for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Registration will take place from 8 to 8:30 at Barrett Park at 4840 Barrett Parkway, and the walk begins at 9. All right. Looks like it's 4:30 already, so that means it's time for a break, and Priscilla will have more news when we return.
People with disabilities adapt on a daily basis. They're people you want on your team. And we're here to help you find blind and visually impaired professionals to help you reach your organizational goals. Building an inclusive workforce where individuals with disabilities are welcome is possible thanks to Mass Commission for the Blind. Partner with them to hire individuals who are blind or visually impaired and reach your workforce goals. The success of your organization depends on the diversity of your team. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB to learn how you can become an employer partner for the blindness community. That's 1-800-392-6450 or mass.gov/MCB.
And we're back. You're listening to Community News, Fitchburg-Lemonster, a production of the Audio Journal. Okay, in case you have nothing to do this evening and you're interested in poetry, from the Lunenburg Library, celebrate the joy of poetry, music, and storytelling at a lively and engaging event with acclaimed Lunenburg poet, harper, and storyteller Kate Chadbourne this spring. It's actually tonight. This one-hour program titled An Evening of Poetry and Song will be held at 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, April 29th at the Lunenburg Public Library, 1023 Massachusetts Avenue. Participants of all ages and experience levels are invited to discover the poetic spirit within themselves. The evening will feature a delightful traditional Irish tale about a most unlikely poet, one who can barely string three words together, proving that creativity often emerges in the most unexpected ways, said Chadbourne, who will perform a selection of classic poems she has artfully set to music for harp and piano, blending literary tradition with rich musical expression. Audience members will have the chance to collaborate in creating a spontaneous, humorous group poem in what promises to be the most effortless and entertaining poem-making experience imaginable. With laughter, creativity, and a touch of magic, my wish is that my guests may find themselves surprised by their own wit and imagination, Chadbourne said with a smile. By the end of this joyful hour, I hope you will all leave inspired and perhaps newly confident in calling yourselves poets. This free program is open to the public. No prior experience with poetry or music is required. Just bring your curiosity and sense of fun, she concluded. For more information on this event or to register, visit the Lunenburg Public Library's calendar at lunenburglibrary.org or call 978-582-4140. For more information on Kate Chadbourne, visit her website at katechadbourne.com. Excuse me. And here's Sally Cragen's Pet Talk column. This one is titled, Van Cats Love to Swim, and They Look Like Cow Cats. Dear Pet Talk, why does Reggie have spots? What kind of cat is he? Is he going to bite me? Does he like to be petted? It's signed fourth grade students in Mrs. Thomas's classroom, Crocker Elementary School, Fitchburg. Dear students, we really enjoyed bringing Therapaw's therapy pets to visit you all in your classroom recently. You had so many great questions about Reggie and Kiefer that we will answer all those questions over the next 2 weeks. Individual cat markings are like individual attributes of human beings. We are all different, and so it is with cats. Reggie is a Van cat. His origins come from the area of Lake Van in Armenia. Now the cats that are from that area are actually very different. Long-haired Angora-style fur with orange spots, including an orange tail. The classic Van is a cat known to love water and swimming. Here's a fun story. In the mid-1950s, Westerners first discovered the Van through pictures by photographers Laura Lushington, 1920 to 2015, and Sonia Halliday. Lushington had served in the British Women's Auxiliary Air Force during World War II. After the war, she loved visiting the Holy Lands and the Near East to photograph religious sites. During one journey, the pair were given a pair of white and orange kittens. And any time Laura and Sonia stopped during their journey, they were astounded to see the kittens jump into a pond or stream for a swim. Vans were not brought to the United States until 1982, although the International Cat Association recognized them in 1979. However, I can tell you for a fact that there were plenty of white cats with black spots in New England many years earlier, because when I was a child, I had one. We used to call them cow cats because they resembled Holstein cows. In my experience, the classic markings of a cow cat are black tail, black spots on back and flanks, black toe beans, and two black spots on the head where motorcycle goggles could be positioned. Reggie has all of those markings and, like a cow, is a slow-moving fellow. He is also a very rich and resonant purr, as you've heard. He also loves to hear children read stories to him, and the public will be able to meet him during the Public Safety Day at Fitchburg Fire Department, 33 North Street in Fitchburg, on Saturday, May 2nd, from 9:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. That would be this coming Saturday. And that's it. Okay. More about animals. This from Vermont. It's a sheep and her rare sextuplets. Ooh. From Underhill, Vermont. Anne O'Connor just kept counting sheep, and it made her anything but sleepy. A sheep owned by O'Connor, who runs Clover and Bee Farm in Underhill, Vermont, with her husband Gunnar, gave birth to a rare batch of six lambs earlier this month. The sextuplets and their mother are all doing well, making lamb windfall even more remarkable. The same ewe previously had quadruplets, and while a recent checkup indicated she would have two lambs this time, O'Connor suspected more. When the big day came, the baby lambs seemed to have kept coming and coming, she said. I was a little bit suspicious, just given how big she was, and she was going a little earlier, that she might have more than two, she said. Six is great, but it's definitely plenty. Sources differ on how uncommon sheep sextuplets are, with O'Connor putting the number around 1 in 1,000, and some agricultural websites placing it at 1 in 1,000,000 or higher. Wow. O'Connor said she has been in touch with the Vermont Sheep and Goat Association about the births, and the group found only one other shepherd where the sheep had given birth to so many lambs. They do take longer to reach full body weight, but most do just fine, said Kristen Judkins of Gilead Fiber Farm, who owned a ewe that had sextuplets 3 years in a row, in an email. You have to keep an eye on them for the first few weeks to make sure they're getting enough to eat. The lambs, which are partially the Finn sheep breed, are named the numbers 1 through 6 in Finnish. Their mother is named Timu, after a Finnish hockey player and Hockey Hall of Famer Timu Salane. The O'Connors plan to keep the four ewes and find homes for the two male lambs. The farm raises sheep for wool and also grows herbs and berries. It's headed for its fifth summer raising sheep. The flock is booming, along with two other recent babies. The six new lambs have brought the total up to 21, and five ewes are currently pregnant. Timu's breeding days are likely not over. She'll be allowed a respite, but odds are good she'll have more lambs in the future, O'Connor said. She's a great mom. She's doing an awesome job with this, O'Connor said. She's still very much in her reproductive years, so probably a year or more, and she'll just, you know, be able to put her hooves up. Okay. And from Groton, Destination Groton releases its new 10-year vision report. The Destination Groton Committee recently released its report, Groton 2036, a 10-year vision. The document is a result of a nearly four-year effort to research the issues and engage the public in a town-wide conversation, imagining a framework to incrementally improve and enhance Groton's town center experience. I'm pleased to receive this timely 10-year vision report from the Destination Groton Committee, Town Manager Mark Haddad said. It represents a deep dive into the challenges the town faces and offers a series of thoughtful and compelling findings and recommendations to meet these challenges over the next 10 years. Excuse me. The DGC was awarded two state grants, Massachusetts Downtown Initiative, which is $25,000, traffic mobility, and the Rural Development Fund, or $50,000 for town center planning. While funded to focus on town center, the DGC included review of potential sites around town, including Four Corners and West Groton. For the traffic mobility consultant, DGC hired Stantec, and for the town planning consultant, they hired Studio In Situ Architects. A visioning process is a collaborative effort to imagine and define a community's long-term aspirations for a specific area as a shared statement of possibility, a roadmap of ideas and priorities that reflect the community's values, identity, and hopes for the future so that policymakers can act to create that future, DGC Chair Greg Sheldon stated. That process continues, he added. The DGC began its downtown conversation by publishing a public town survey 2023-24 with 400-plus respondents that was designed to establish baseline community priorities and to confirm townwide support, 83%, for pursuing a long-term vision and associated funding opportunities. In addition, the DGC held two well-attended business conferences in April 2024 with 95 attendees, Creating Business Opportunities for Economic Growth, and November 2024 with 90 attendees, Visioning the Future of Town Center. The DGC launched a second public survey in 2025 to extend the public conversation. The second survey focuses on current conditions along Main Street, priorities for infrastructure, and safety improvements and community support for a long-term town center vision. The consultants began their work early in 2025 and held several public engagements. The DGC set out in the fall to host a series of six visioning forums with town residents. Each forum combined a concise presentation of context and findings with open discussion and facilitated questions. Presentations explained by why Groton Town Center is at an inflection point, summarized preliminary consultant insights, and described how public input would shape the vision final report and subsequent implementation phases. The vision report recognizes that long-standing mobility and infrastructure constraints now intersect with increased cultural activity, visitor traffic, and measurable retail leakage. Addressing these safety and economic conditions requires a phased, coordinated, and character-sensitive approach. We look forward to the next phase in presenting the vision report findings and recommendations going forward to town leadership, beginning with the select board and other town leaders and the public, Sheldon said. To view Groton 2036, a 10-year vision, and to review all background documents, go to destinationgroton.com and click on Vision Process page. And we're coming up on 4:45. I don't think I have time to read another article, so we'll send it back to Stacy.
Hello, everybody. This is Bill Ruggiero. Join me for my live weather reports heard every weekday mornings on the Morning Report right here on Audio Journal. Get your first forecast without waiting for a forecaster. That's the Morning Report heard every weekday mornings from 7:30 a.m. to 8 a.m. only from Audio Journal, part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
And we're back for the final segment of community news for the Fitchburg and Leominster area on Audio Journal. All right, here is an editorial. Healy's bill would curb town's Devonzoni veto power. A major economic development bill filed by Governor Healy last week contains a provision that would significantly restructure the approval process for zoning changes at Devons. According to the Harvard Press, it would replace the existing supertown meeting route with a single region-wide vote conducted by Mass Development, the state's quasi-public development finance agency, and Devon's overseer. If passed, the changes would take effect January 1, 2027. Under current law, amendments to the reuse plan and zoning bylaws must be approved by town meetings of all three communities, Ayr, Harvard, and Shirley, meeting on the same date and time. Devon spans parts of all three towns. The weekly newspaper, the Harvard Press, indicated that Healy's bill would replace that procedure with a single town meeting convened by Mass Development at one location. Any voter registered in the three towns, as well as Devon's residents, would be eligible to vote at that meeting. Since Devon's isn't an independent municipality, its residents vote in the town that their address historically encompasses. The bill directs the clerks of Ayr, Harvard, and Shirley to verify the registration status of all attendings, with Mass Development covering the cost of that work. The legislation, which is called Mass Wins Act, gives Mass Development sole authority to propose changes to the Devon's reuse plan and zoning at the former U.S. Army base. Mass Development would draft the language of any changes and hold at least two public hearings to hear public comment. Mass Development, rather than the towns, would convene the meeting and present its changes. A quorum of 50 voters would be sufficient to conduct business. A single majority vote in favor of Mass Development proposals by those in attendance would be sufficient to pass them. Attendees would have no ability to make amendments from the floor. Only an up or down vote would be permitted. Once passed, the changes become effective immediately. The governor said her proposal would, quote, reform the way zoning changes are made in Devons to ensure the community's zoning bylaws can be amended in a timely way and enable the meaningful participation of Devons residents as well as surrounding municipalities. The financial burden of educating an influx of children that would accompany additional housing has long been an obstacle to further residential growth. Removal of that resistance to residential expansion came through a significant policy change. Signed into law in November 2024, the legislation removed that long-standing 282 housing unit cap, clearing the way for larger scale residential development. The first substantial result occurred a few days before Christmas of that year. That's when Mass Development issued requests for proposals from developers to build new housing on two residentially zoned parcels, about 6.6 acres at Adams Circle and 62.7 acres along Grant Road, where development would expand one of the community's largest residential neighborhoods. The Mass LEEDS Act also established a working group that recommended housing be allowed in the Innovation and Technology Center zoning district. While the bill required the working group to investigate the feasibility of building up to 400 multifamily residential units, the area would need to be rezoned residential before housing development could occur. According to previous reportings, officials of the three towns have told the state that they would support such a zoning change. With this proposed legislation, it appears the governor wants to streamline all Devon zoning changes and other transactions with one regional town meeting vote orchestrated by Mass Development. Well, that's interesting. Let's see. Well, here's another article that follows up on a topic that we have been following for years, really. Market Basket needs a unified family behind it. Now that ousted Market Basket CEO Arthur T. DeMoulas has lost his court battle to be reinstated, the central element in this prolonged family power struggle would seem to be finally settled. However, uncertainty over the future of his highly successful Tewksbury-based supermarket chain remains. Delaware Court Vice Chancellor J. Travis Laster ruled last week that members of Market Basket's board of directors did not act in bad faith when they suspended DeMoulas last May before terminating him in September. Laster agreed with the concerns raised by the board that DeMoulas neither took direction properly nor shared pertinent financial information. The judge wrote that DeMoulas, quote, proved to be an excellent operator but an imperious leader. This follows a trial that took place in December where Market Basket's holding company is incorporated in Delaware to protect its decision to fire DeMoulas. The company's bylaws allow the board to fire the chief executive without cause. Board Chair Jay Hatchiganian testified at the trial that the board fired DeMoulas without cause, but, quote, for good reasons. The board added that the chain, which generates about $8 billion in annual revenue, will continue to be family-owned and operated. This court victory represents a long-sought vindication for DeMoulas' three sisters, Frances, Karen, and Glorianne, who together own over 60% of the shares in Market Basket, compared with the 28% owned by their brother. In somewhat of a conciliatory statement, board members thanked DeMoulas for his many years of service and said that they anticipate working with him productively into the future as one of the company's important shareholders. Let's see. The British retail analysis firm Dunnhumby earlier this year named Market Basket the second best grocery operation in the country for a second time, trailing only a Texas-based chain. But internal distractions could threaten that standing, as well as increase competitive pressures that have become more pronounced since DeMoulas' suspension and firing. This DeMoulas saga also inadvertently disclosed another legal family dispute. Litigation in Massachusetts probate court has been playing out over the inheritance of Arthur T. and his three sisters' 14 children. That's another chapter in this Greek tragedy. And what, if any, input will Artie T., now 71, have in the management of the supermarket chain that he's nurtured his entire adult life? If the board truly anticipates working with him productively into the future, they'd be wise to do so. Among his many talents, he's proven to have an uncanny ability in selecting the next locations for expanding the supermarket chain, which has recently made inroads into the main market. That somehow will take overcoming the ill will that has festered for so many years. Well, let's hope they get that straightened out. Well, let's see. We're coming up to the end of the program, but let's take a moment to reflect on this day in history. Today in history, a jury in California acquitted four Los Angeles police officers charged with assault and using excessive force in the videotaped beating of motorist Rodney King. That's in 1992. Sorry. Also on this date, in 1862, a Union naval force commanded by Flag Officer Farragut captured New Orleans in the Civil War. The North would eventually take control of the entire Mississippi River. On this date in 1944, American soldiers liberated the Dachau concentration camp in Nazi Germany. Well, that's all we've got time for today, except that I'll say in 2011, Prince William and Kate Middleton were married. So happy anniversary to them. This Community Knows program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you'd like a hard copy of our program schedule in large print or braille, call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Stacy Lanier. I've been reading today with Priscilla Lanigan. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. Video chats help us keep in touch when we're far apart. And now, some birds are in on the fun, too. Knowing how clever parrots are, researchers wanted to see how they'd respond to another parrot saying hi on a tablet or phone. Researchers taught the parrots how to signal they wanted to make a call by ringing a bell, so they could decide for themselves to participate.
Do you want to call a friend?
The bird's caretaker would show the parrot a screen with photos of birds to choose from by touching.
You want to call Rosie?
Then the person would start the call.
Want to say hi? Where is she? Yes. There she is. Yes, that's Rosie. Yes.
Many parrots chatted amiably during the call, behaving much like wild birds keeping in touch with their flock. They often stayed on the phone for the maximum allowed 5 minutes. Some birds even learned skills from each other and seemed to form lasting friendships, continuing to call each other after the experiment. The researchers think that video chats could help enrich the lives of birds in captivity. Sometimes, it's just nice to have a friend to squawk on the phone with. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Remmel. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot see.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/mcb.